When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 107 of VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so that you don't miss any of the big name guests that I've got lined up for you with new VRP Rocks episodes dropping every single Monday. Now, today's guest is a rock guitarist whose career really took off in the 80s playing with Doro Pesch in her band Warlock, and then when she went under the name Doro too. But it's his long-standing 20-year-plus association as Dokken's lead guitar player that he's best known for. I am, of course, talking about John Levin. Dokken have a new album out now. It's called Heaven Comes Down, available everywhere you get your music, so please do check that out. Musically gifted from a very early age, John was inspired by the guitar gods Hendrix, Clapton, Van Halen and the likes. His first break came when he was just 22 years old with Warlock, headlining stadium tours in Europe at such a young age. He later effectively became George Lynch's long-term replacement in Dokken, but in between became an entertainment lawyer, family lawyer, and ran his own label too. So this chat is another fascinating one as we dive into his history from that prodigious musical young age, what it was like working with Doro and her band and the fame, then the grunge years that came along and he sidestepped the world of being a musician, and then what pulled him back. And he's honest to say that if he'd known who he was auditioning for, he probably would never have gone through with it. We hear about the sliding doors moment, a steakhouse mix-up that could have seen it all go wrong before it even begun, and how he felt taking over from Mr. Nasty, George Lynch, working and writing with Dokken and his relationship with Don, trying to keep the feel of the original band at heart whilst recording new albums. He also addresses the criticism Don Dokken receives for his vocal style, and we hear all about the band's new album, Heaven Comes Down, how it came together and what it means to John, his fourth record with the band, which is out now. He's a fun, honest character, so I know you're going to enjoy this one. So here's my chat with Dokken guitarist John Levin. Now, I'm delighted to be joined on VRP Rocks by the wonderful John Levin from Dokken. Dokken have got a brand new album out, and we're looking forward to hearing all about that. But as always, on VRP Rocks, we like to hear more about the person as well, the individual artist and their history and their stories too. So, John, we're going to take you back to when you were very young. Now, you, as a youngster, 4 or 5, you picked up the piano and then the violin and then the trumpet, and you finally found the guitar. So, obviously, you're very musically talented, you're very versatile. So, was it something from a very early age that you kind of thought and you recognized it was what you wanted to do with your life?
For some reason, like for me, music just came really naturally to me, and learning in school was hard. Actually, I was good in math, but like English and reading, I had a really, really difficult time with reading comprehension. You know, I hit sixth grade and like my parents probably finally figured out, well, he can't read. Like, it wasn't that I couldn't read, but I couldn't pay attention. You know, I have like a horrible, horrible attention deficit. And back in those days, like, no one really understood that, you know. But for the part of my brain that was had a real, you know, learning perception problem with that, I had no problem for some reason with music. Like, it just came really natural to me. So there was that some sort of a dichotomy there. So with the music, you know, we had a piano in my living room growing up. There was like nothing else in the living room but this piano, to be honest, you know. And my older sister would play. She took lessons and she was playing like classical pieces, you know. And I was just really young, 3 or 4 or something like that. I was little. Wow. And I started to fiddle around a little bit on there. And then from there, I started to take some violin lessons in school. And, you know, I was probably in second grade for violin. And I couldn't really, I played a little bit, but then I got onto trumpet and I became a good horn player. And I did that for however old you are in fourth, fifth, and sixth. From fourth grade through the end of high school, I played trumpet. But I found a guitar in the basement when I was 9. And I guess my mom had some nylon string guitar. She didn't know how to play it or anything, but she had it. And then once I found that, I noodled around a little on it. And I had a friend of mine, I used to go, you know, over to his house and I was a kid, you know. And he had an electric guitar with an amp, a little amp and an electric guitar. And this book of the Beatles complete. I remember it really. It was like a black book, like this thick. And it had like a whole ton of songs in there. And of course, I was familiar with some of the Beatles songs because, you know, who wasn't? Even as a real young kid. And I just saw the tablature writing, how they would write out chords with lines. So, and I just immediately took to that. And I was playing pretty much right away just by that, you know, and then took it from there. I got my first electric guitar at 11. And yeah, that's how it started.
Wow, incredible. So obviously you're young, you're playing along with the Beatles and things, but who were your kind of early inspirations then when it came to guitar?
You know, it came in phases for me. The first inspirations that really got me better as a player were Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix. And I'll explain to you how that happened. See, for guitar, it's one thing to play basic chords, like in the first position, you know? But then once you get into bending and putting vibrato on a note, which is really what defines someone's personality as a player, is really how they bend in their vibrato, what they sound like, you know, that's a very big learning curve to go from that, from chords to bending with vibrato. Like, that's a very big transition. And what got me to that was learning Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix. Like, I learned that Crossroads solo when I was in seventh grade, sixth grade. And I was still to this day, I can grab a guitar and play that like note for note. Like, it just buried into my head. I learned that one and I learned like probably Purple Haze and a few other ones. And that got me into the bending. And then, you know, sure enough, one day I'm 14 or 15 and someone plays me Eruption. And that was the end of it. Then I was completely like, I didn't believe it was a guitar when I heard that.
Yeah. Completely unique, isn't it? Absolutely. Just a quick question. You mentioned in Van Halen there. I've got one here from Play Disc Golf on YouTube. He says, I know you're a big fan of Eddie Van Halen. What's your favorite Eddie solo and what's your favorite Van Halen song?
Oh, wow. So if I had to pick one song, I'm going to pick Mean Streets. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to pick Unchained. Actually, yeah. Unchained would be my favorite song, although it's all such genius. You know, one thing, if you go back and listen to everything, anything Ed did, it doesn't matter what, anything, listen to any solo, anything he did. Some guitar players have like moments of brilliance. Do you know what I mean? And then there's other moments where it's like, okay, with Ed Van Halen, every single microsecond, every nanosecond of what he touched on guitar was brilliance.
Yeah.
That's why he was, you know, he was here. And then the next level of great players was like down here. There's a whole bunch of guys down here, but to me, he was the only one there, you know, and that's what it was for me with him. I mean, it was just he was just absolute magic.
Did you ever get to meet him at all?
We got the privilege of opening up for Van Halen. I think it was 2015. We did a gig together. We opened for them. And I meet him. I met him very briefly. We have a photo together. But, you know, I was standing on the side of the stage watching him. A mutual friend of ours was Ed's and, you know, main person, right-hand man. And he brought me up there to watch, you know. And at one point in the show, Ed came over to me and said something, whispered into my, like, talking into my ear while he had but I couldn't hear him. You know, because it was so loud, but I have no idea what he said. Maybe he was saying something like, get off the stage. I don't know. I don't think so. He was smiling. He was happy and smiling, and he leaned over and said something to me, but I just don't know what it was.
Oh, incredible stuff. And just moving forward a few years, obviously, you went to college. Your parents, I think, one's a teacher. And was one a doctor or something like that, or a lawyer?
Yeah, dad was a dentist and mom was a teacher. Yeah,
oh, there you go. So the college was kind of the only route for you, but you ended up dropping out of college to become a musician. So how tough a conversation was that with your parents at the time?
That didn't go over well. You know, that was a very big turning point for you know, I guess in everyone's life, if you look back on your life, there's always a few moments that really set you on a path, right or left, like if you're at a fork, you know what I mean? So, you know, my parents came from educated backgrounds. I worked really hard to get into this business school. My dad wanted me to be a doctor. I didn't want to do that. I couldn't stand the sight of blood, to be honest, you know, as a kid. And it wasn't for me. So I was going to go to this business school. It was, you know, 4-year degree. But after 2 years, I got into the program and then I decided I didn't want to do it. I met some other guys. They were all, as a kid, I always had a tendency to play with older guys than me. You know, and I met these guys. We did a demo. I was 19 and it came out really good. We had like a little 45 we pressed. It was two songs. And then next thing you know, we started a band. And I decided, you know what, I got to go for this. And I had to go back home and say to my parents, I'm not going back to college. So I dropped out. And that's what put me on the path to where I got to today. Because what happened was we played in the clubs in Long Island. The band got some notoriety. We started selling out. And that's what led me to get the call into Doro's band. Because Tommy Henriksen, who was in Doro's band at the time, called me. Either he called me or Joey Ballon called me first. But regardless, that's how I got it, because Tommy saw me play at a club. And that's what set my whole music career in motion.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Warlock there and Doro. You joined kind of after the big break from the Triumph and Agony album, didn't you? So how was that for being part of that band at that time?
Oh, it was great because, you know, a lot of musicians struggle many, many stepping stones to get from playing in clubs to playing in an arena. And for me, I just went from club, boom, opening for Ozzy Osbourne. So, you know, and I was only 22 or 23. So that was a pretty big thing. You know, our first tour was that my first world tour I did was a headlining tour. So that was pretty good, you know. So
is that kind of dream come true moments then? Obviously, you're 22, you're headlining in stadiums and world tours and stuff. I mean, how bizarre is that?
Yeah, it was pretty surreal. What the for me, the one of the greatest things about it, frankly, was that my parents calmed down once, you know, we did the videos and got on MTV and all that. Then they calmed them down, which was good, you know?
Yeah, they saw it was an actual real thing that you were doing, yeah.
Yeah, all of a sudden I knew it was going to work out when my dad one day came home with a whole bunch of luggage for me. Like he bought me nice luggage saying, hey, you're going to need this, you know. I'm thinking, okay, that's really nice, you know.
Oh, it's a nice touch. It's a nice touch indeed. And then obviously from Warlock, you worked with Doro on her solo stuff, Force Majeure. And again, that was another big record. I mean, was being on that record and recording on that record, was that your first real taste of being in a studio then? Because obviously you'd done bits before with your earlier bands, but was that your kind of first taste of almost the big time?
Yeah, that was my first real album I did, was Force Majeure. I mean, up to that point, I probably actually recorded about an album or so's worth of material in a real studio. So we did, in the club band I was in, we had some backing and we probably did about one album's worth of properly recorded things. So I had some experience, you know, but that the Warlock thing was definitely my first real experience. I mean, we did it at the Right Track Studios in New York. It's not even there anymore, but that was a famous place, you know, right there on 47th Street where all the music stores were. 48th Street, I think. Yeah, 48th. And yeah, it was great, you know.
And talk to me about Doro as well, because obviously she's one of the real pioneers for women in metal. And she was obviously huge across here in Europe, obviously. And what was she like to work with? And what was her aura like at the time?
She's wonderful. I mean, you're not going to find... She's like one of the hardest working people in rock and roll. I mean, every performance she would do was like balls to the wall, pedal to the metal. Like, she would give 150%. Like, there was no, like, you know, she just went for it. There was no phoning it in with her, you know? And she still's like that. I mean, I saw her, and I see videos of her on YouTube. I mean, she's, like, incredible.
And I've got a question here from Richard Lundberg is the next one. He says, how would you sum up your time with Warlock and Doro?
Really wonderful. The band was great. It was Bobby Rondelli on drums, Tommy Henriksen on guitar. It was a great, great experience. Loved, you know, I think the tour was great that we did together. Proud of how the album came out. I mean, it was, what's great about, you know, having albums from your past is like, there's a good snapshot in time. So like, you can go back and say, okay, like, this is where my head was musically at that point in time, you know? So it allowed me to sort of document that too, you know, but great. It was just great. Great. Wonderful experience.
And then, moving forward a couple of years, obviously the whole kind of grunge movement, the swell of it. And I've heard you say before that after Nirvana hit the scene, it did away with guitarists who like to do solos and all that sort of stuff. So you took a different path at this stage, didn't you? You went down the law school route and became an entertainment lawyer and a family lawyer eventually.
Yeah.
And things like that. Did you think at that stage that your musical career was maybe over then?
I definitely did. When I went to law school, I really didn't play guitar much. I studied so hard. I just wanted to do this. And as soon as the grunge thing came, there was no more of that. You know, it wasn't even cool to do solos anymore, you know, it's not that I didn't like that music. There's some wonderful songs from that era. It just wasn't what I wanted to play. So I just looked at it as like, wow, like everything I ever worked for and wanted to do no longer exists in the world, you know? So I was on the phone with my dad, and he said to me, well, yeah, he goes to me, you have two choices. You can either go work in the record store or go to law school. So like that was the gap in his mind, that was the gamut: record store, law school. Nothing in between. It was just those two things, you know? So, I just was concerned about having no money, because when I moved out to Los Angeles, I didn't have any money. I lived in a 2-bedroom apartment with 3 people, you know, the singer and the band. I had at the time slept on the couch. You know, we were all waking up at 4:30 in the morning to go sell, you know, computer parts over in a boiler operation. You know what I mean? It was tough just to make, you know, if you were lucky, you know, I'd make enough to pay my rent for the month. I think my rent was like $300.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Just shows you, doesn't it? Well, a question here from Johnny Riggs, which you might have answered, but he says, did you keep up with your guitar playing while you are out of the scene? I know you said you didn't do much while you were in law school, but while you were practicing, did you keep up with your guitar then? Or was it like riding a bike when you were asked to come back?
I played in law school. You know, I played during the weekends just in my room, just as a break for an hour, sometimes here and there, once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. After law school, once I graduated law school in 96, I opened up my own practice right away. And it was in 90, I met Jeff Pilson around that time, because through Tommy Henriksen. So we knew each other, and I know Jeff knew I was a guitar player. So 98 came about. So it wasn't too much longer after that. Plus I had a record label for a minute there, but between 96 or 97 and 98, you know, 98 was when the Dokken call came. And at that point, between 96 and 98, from when I started law school in 93 to 98, I had very limited guitar playing at that point. You know, I wasn't playing all that much. So when the Dokken call came, you know, I was almost not, first of all, I didn't know it was for Dokken. And, you know, I wasn't really in practice or anything.
And did you miss it?
I think I got to a point where in my heart at that time, I resolved that the music career was behind me and I was comfortable with it. Like I had short hair, cut my hair off. I co-owned a record label with a friend of mine. We had a real record label. Like we had bands signed to major labels through it, you know, through us in office space and the whole thing. And, you know, I just was more into the business end. And I, in my mind, my music career as a player was behind me. You know?
But that wasn't to be. And as you said, you knew Jeff, you met Jeff, and then you got the call from Jeff. So, so tell us how that story came about.
Okay, I'll try and give you a quick version. After work, I'm in a suit, go to my dad's. I had an office in Century City here in Los Angeles. Go to my dad's place, 10 minutes away from there, to have supposed to have dinner at his place. Check my office voicemail. Jeff called. There was a call from Jeff. And the call, from my recollection, said something like, hey, you know, we're in the studio. We need a guitar player to play some solos. Our guitar player quit. Would you be able to come down and play? So I hung up the phone after checking my messages. My dad said to me, anything interesting? I'm like, yeah, you know, a friend of mine asked me to come play some guitar solos, but I'm not going to go. He's like, my dad's like, go. I'm like, I'm not going to go. I haven't hardly play anymore. He pushed me into it. And Jeff didn't say it was for Dokken on that message, or had he done so, or had I heard that, I would never have gone, because I would have been too, not going to play with Dokken. I haven't played guitar in years. So I went down there. I drove down to Redondo Beach. It was Don's studio. I didn't know that at the time. I was still in the suit, you know? So I knocked on the door, and then Don opened the door and then just had a Les Paul in his hand and threw a Les Paul at me, you know? And said, here, play. And I said to him, can I hear the tracks first? And he said, no, it's in E, just solo. So I was like, okay. Didn't want to let me hear it. So they hit play. And pretty quickly, I played two solos. I did one for a song called The Irish Song, and one for what was a demo of The Maddest Hatter. That version of The Irish Song was released in Japan. And then that's how that started. Then a couple of weeks later, Jeff called me again, said, hey, we're headlining the Dallas Starplex July 4th. Can you learn all these songs and do the gig? And I'm like, yeah, I can do it. And that's how it started. That was 98. There's more to the story if you want. I don't know how deep you want to get. There's some more interesting twists, but that was part one.
Well, I was just going to say, before we get to part two then, have you ever spoken to Don about what his first feelings and thoughts are? Because obviously, what is it, your first 7 seconds of meeting somebody, you form an impression, and then you walk in with your suit and your short hair. I wonder what he thought of you, your initial appearance.
You know what? That's a great question. I've never asked him what he thought. I just assumed what he would have thought. I assumed he must have been, when Jeff said, oh, my friend John, he's a lawyer, he's going to come down and play, Don must have been like, what? Come on. I would think he'd be skeptical. But now that I know Don so well, he doesn't think like most other people. Like, he's a lot more open-minded to talent. We've had discussions before, and like, he believes, like, you know, talent comes in all shapes, sizes, and forms, you know, Yeah. So I think that's what made him more open to it.
Interesting. And I wonder if this is part two. I heard a funny story you once told about a steakhouse mix-up. Is that was the early days of Dokken, and I almost missed.
That was.
Go and tell us.
That's part two. Yeah. So we were rehearsing for that July 4th Dallas Starplex show. And Jeff was coming to my, he came to my house a couple of times, and we rehearsed in Don's studio a couple of times. And then Don said, hey, you know, we're going to play for my birthday. He owned a club, Don. It was called the Redondo Beach Stakeout. Yeah. And Don's birthday is June 29th. He's like, you know, he called me up, and, you know, I was a little taken aback of speaking to Don, and I don't know Redondo Beach down here. It's very confusing down there. I'm not from that area. And he told me really quickly, like, where to go with the directions, and I tried to write it down really fast. And I thought he said steakhouse, not stakeout. So I drove down there with my girlfriend Kim at the time. And after looking around for an hour and a half, couldn't find anything, stopping in the gas stations, trying to, you know, find out where to go. I said to her, all right, forget it. Let's just go home. And had I missed that show, I'm sure they would have been like, forget it. You know, a guy doesn't show up for a gig, he's done. So we're driving home, and Kim said to me, hey, what are all those people doing in that parking lot out there? Wait, is it the stakeout? I'm like, that's got to be it. And slow and behold, you know, she found it.
That's fate smiling down upon you, absolutely.
Yeah, that was just luck.
Definitely. And another question that you probably get asked an awful lot, and it's a natural one to ask probably, but George Lynch, his work with the band is obviously synonymous with the early success and everything like that. I mean, obviously an incredible guitarist as well. Did you feel any pressure when you stepped into that spot, knowing that George was a major part of the early success of the band?
You know, that's, for some reason, that's just one thing about how my mind works, that it doesn't affect me like that. For whatever reason, like, it didn't. I guess had I thought about it and tripped out on it, maybe it could have. But for whatever reason, like, that, my personality doesn't do that, luckily. So it didn't affect me that way. I'm a huge fan of George's and his talent, but I never like got into that headspace of, you know what I'm saying, to try and like trip out on getting nervous about that whole factor. You know, I seem to always, just in my life in general, even as a lawyer, like, for some reason, I seem to like do well under pressure usually. Like, it seems to. I usually can't even get things done until I feel some sort of pressure, to be honest. Like, if I don't feel pressure, I won't do anything.
I love it. So the first album you did with Doc, and then Hell to Pay. What was the creative process like with that record then? Because obviously you're quite new through the door at that stage. Was it easy or difficult to get your ideas across?
Well, on that one, we did it at Don's. Don was living out in the valley in Newbury Park at the time. So I would drive out to his house and we'd work in his studio, or his studio up. He had his studio built in there. But, you know, I was new to the band, so I was less reluctant to be vocal or to say opinions. You know, I collaborated on the songs with Don, but I was more timid in terms of saying what I think we should do. And on the follow-up to that, on The Lightning Strikes Again, I said to Don, man, we got to do like something that fits inside the Doc and Camp, you know, let's, you know. And he said to me, I don't know how to do that. He's like, John, you don't understand, like, I wrote those songs, however, like 30 years ago was at the time, or whatever, however many years it had been. So I said to him, you know what, let me make you like a mix of all those old tunes, just throw it on in your car and get your head maybe back into that headspace, you know. And then I started playing him riffs, ideas I had that I felt, you know, could not like rip off riffs. Like, I had the riff to Oasis, for example, you know, and then, you know, he heard it, and that we went from there.
Interesting question, kind of follow up there from one of the subscribers, Mark Rice. He says, Dokken's my favorite group of all time. How do you balance the iconic back catalogue of songs with the desire to create new music that resonates with a modern audience and the old faithful like me?
You know, that's a great question. And it isn't the easiest thing to do, because you don't want to like start ripping off and recreating, you know. So that's never a good idea. It's got to be genuine. And I personally feel like on this newest album, we managed to accomplish it. And it wasn't by design. It just organically happened. You know, if you try to do something, sometimes it can sound too forced. But, you know, that's a really good question. And especially true with the set, because if we're going to start playing some of these new songs, but then it becomes the question of, well, then what do you take out? You know, so, yeah, you know, we'll add in Gypsy or whatever. And what do we take out then? You know, again, certain, you know what I mean? So it's, yeah. Someone's happy, someone's not happy.
So in terms of Lightning Strikes Again and Broken Bones, the albums that followed, you said you're a bit timid on the first record that you did. So what was it like, the writing process between you and Don for those ones then? Are you more kind of coming up with stuff and giving them to him and saying, this is what we do, or we should do
on
this?
On Lightning Strikes Again, I would have riff ideas, you know. For example, like, I had the Oasis riff. Usually I could have a riff and like a verse or something. I wasn't recording anything onto Pro Tools at that point for Lightning Strikes Again. Because I figured, let me just get a whole bunch of things I feel like are ideas that are in the camp and see if anything triggers with Don. So I would go to his place. I'm like, hey, man, I got a couple ideas. Let me play this for you. And with Don, like, if I play an idea and he instantaneously starts singing something, we know he got something to work on. So that's how I would approach it. And, you know, he also would play guitar and sometimes and play me ideas. Hey, I got this. Or I'd play a riff and then he'd say, that's cool for the verse. I'm hearing this. And then he'd play me something and we would collaborate like that. This latest record, of course, was done completely differently due to the COVID thing. But that's how we did Broken Bones and Lightning Strikes Again. We collaborated in a room together and made demos.
The old-fashioned way, indeed.
Yeah, that's how we did it. Yeah,
absolutely. So we're mentioning the new album, Heaven Comes Down. It's the band's 13th album. It's your fourth album with the group as well. It's out now. It's got some really good reviews. I've got a couple here to read out. Blabbermouth said, the most enjoyable album the band have made in a long time. Ultimate Classic Rock says, the whole album rattles windows in a good way. I like that one. That's really nice. So tell us about this. Cool. You said it was written during COVID time. So tell us all about this new album.
Well, on this one, see, my biggest problem with Pro Tools has always been, I was never able to overcome how to do drums. In the, you know, I had studios in the past, but I had a drum machine, like this little Roland R5 or whatever. And I was really good at programming drums on that. And I lost the power cable to it and I threw the whole unit out. And I never was able to overcome, like, how do I do drums in Pro Tools? How do you do drums in Pro Tools? I got programs, I couldn't figure them out. I mean, loops, I couldn't figure out how to do it. So I never, finally, my Tommy Henriksen, who's still a good friend of mine today, who I played with in Warlock, he was at my house. I'm like, Tommy, man, show me how to do drums. He's like, yeah, it's easy. He's like, he's like, you got some samples? I'm like, yeah, I got samples from wherever. He's like, okay, pull up. He showed me here. You take this, put it here. You just build one little piece at a time, and then you can duplicate it and add fills. I'm like, that's it. And once I learned how to do it, I was on, because I had amassed such a huge collection of stuff I've written in my handheld. Like, anytime I'd write an idea, I'd record it onto my iPhone to the notes, you know, and I would label them like, oh, good idea for docking, you know. So I just started going through those, and I was like so excited, because now I was able to do drums. I had a bass here because Don left the bass for me, and I'm like, wow, I could do full-on demos. So I just started like recording like mad, because during COVID there was nothing really else to do, and I really got into like myself. And into the writing process. Every day I was writing, even in the morning. Like, I used to think I was just a night owl, and ideas would usually come at night, which sometimes they do, like in my twilight or in my sleep, you know. But I was watching a Michael Schenker video, and he's like, yeah, I write early in the morning. I was like, wow, how does he write early in the morning? So, you know what? I started like, as soon as I get up, grabbing a guitar, and I found, you know what, that really worked. I'm actually clearer for music in the early morning. So I would just work all day, come up with ideas. I like something, man. Okay, put this one down. And I would demo full demos. Some of them like complete from A to Z, the whole thing. And a lot of those, I did that for a lot of the songs. Other ones I did just till the solo section and then finished them later. But for like Gypsy and Fugitive, I demoed those from start to finish, sent them to Don. Wow. You know, later on, he came out here after the vaccine became available, and then he worked here. And like, the incredible thing with Don as a writer is like, we set up a mic for him, and first listening of like Fugitive, I put it on, boom, he starts singing the lyrics right off the cuff, like just like that. And some of those parts he sang right there off the cuff are on the album, are the actual recordings, you know. Wow. So that's how it went. That's how we did this one. On Santa Fe, Don did that alone. I had nothing to do with that one. And on Like a Rose, that was a track that Don had. He had music to that and lyrics and melodies. And I rewrote some of the music. I rewrote the guitar track to that. That's how we did this album, out of necessity, because there was no other way to do it with COVID. Now you do it through correspondence. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the way, wasn't it? But in terms of the timing then, was it COVID that kind of... I don't know, gave you the impetus to make the record? Because I think that the previous records you'd done had been like a 4-year gap between, and obviously between COVID and the last album was maybe 8, and we're a few years on from then. So was it COVID that gave you the kick to do this new record?
I think COVID gave me the inspiration to do it. But I'll be quite honestly, what gave me the ability to do it was Tommy showing me how to program drums into Pro Tools. No, I'm dead serious. But without the ability to do that, it was going to have to be done. You got to get an engineer into my house to work. And you can't, because there's a lockdown. So how are we going to do this? So see what I'm saying? Yeah. Whereas always in the past, if I had an idea, I had a Pro Tools studio for Lightning Strikes Again, because we recorded a lot of that guitar tracks, all the guitar tracks in my apartment, actually, where I lived at the time. But Don would hire an engineer that would sit with me and record everything, you know? So I didn't have to deal with that. But on this one, because of COVID, we couldn't do it like that. Nobody could be around anyone. Mm-hmm. So it was really getting over that hurdle of learning how to program drums for me that led me to be able to do it.
So given everything,
and I wanted to do it.
I was going to say, given everything that you've talked about there, and you learning the process and being really hands on with everything, so you must be incredibly proud of this record then, having finally got it finished.
Yeah, I'm really proud of it. You know, when you're in it, we finished it about a year ago, you know, or something like that. So I didn't listen to it for like a year, because when you finish an album, like, you know, Don always says, records aren't finished, they're abandoned. You know, so when we abandon the album, you, at that point, you're like, I've heard each mix, you know, so many times. It's like, you know, we had mastered this record four different times. It's like, okay, do you like 1, 2, 3? I'm sending it to you now. You know, it's like, by the time you're done, it's just like, I don't want to hear this anymore. You know, mm-hmm. I got to get away from it. So when I got back to it, which was like 2 months ago or so, I started listening to it again. I started listening to it again after not having heard it for so long, when we were going to shoot the video for Fugitive. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't know how to play any of these parts. You know, I don't remember. I have to learn the lead. I don't know what I did. So I started listening to it again. And then for me, a lot of the songs started taking on a life of their own. Like, they became their own entity. And I think once that happens, that they become their own thing, which is really good. Like, you hear it with different ears when you don't listen to something for so long. You know, you can listen back to it and you hear it from a different perspective, a fresh perspective, yeah. You know? And that's how I knew I really like what we did here.
Good stuff. We've mentioned Don a few times in his vocals and stuff. I've got to ask you the question, because it's something that a lot of people talk about, and Don has to address it himself as well. A lot of criticism comes his way because he doesn't sound as how he did in his 20s. I mean, he's faced a lot of criticism. He answers back. I mean, what's your say on the way that Don sings now?
I always would, you know, when any time this subject came up, I said, Don, you're you know, however old, sick at the time we did this record, I'm like, you're 68. I mean, it's not fair for anyone to expect you to be singing like you did when you're 20. Yeah. And even if you could, really, are you going to start like doing high screams at 68 years old? I mean, that's not who you are at this point. You know, just be you, you know? And I think that this is a wonderful depiction of, you know, you can, music is emoting, right? It's portraying an emotion, right? You don't have to scream at the top of your lungs in order to do that. I mean, if you look back to the old Doc and stuff, is it really him screaming at the top of his lungs that transferred the emotion mainly? Or is it the quality of his voice and how he delivered the lines and the lyrical content? You know what I'm saying? There's so many bands where the singer screams his head off, but the songs stink. I mean, does it matter? So whenever I hear someone saying, oh, well, he can't sing the high notes, does it really matter? Let me give you an analogy. Certain artists paint with a ton of colors, and they may be able to make it a beautiful painting out of that, right? But then there's other artists that can paint with pencil, draw with a pencil, and it's just the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, right? So it's not necessarily how many colors you have in your box of crayons, right? It's what you do with it. And I think just from a melody and lyrical perspective on this record, I think this is the best, some of the best stuff he's ever done. I mean, if you listen to the ballad, Never Give Up, I said to him, Don, I think this is one of your best vocal performances ever. You know, it just carries so much emotion in it.
Yeah, high praise indeed. Now, obviously, you've known him for a long time. I mean, how does he take that criticism? Because I think a few years ago, it sounded, he was a bit spiky about it, but I think he's a bit more laid back about it now.
Whenever it would come up, I would just, this is the discussion we would have, is just what I just would say to you. I'm like, you know, anyone who says that, it's ridiculous. You know, that has nothing to do with how much emotion you transfer in a musical composition, how high you sing. And so for a guitar player, are you transferring more emotion by how fast you play? Some guys can play one note and it's just like, wow, right? Play one note and play one note great. You know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with playing fast. Obviously I do it too, but you know, when and how you do it, right? It's just it all is about what is being carried forward in the music, the emotion of it, you know? That's how I feel about it.
And there you go. So the brand new album is out now for everyone to listen to. I recommend everyone gets hold of a copy and streams and buys and all that sort of stuff as well. But John, just a few more questions, if you don't mind. Now, obviously, sure. Within the band Dokken and the former members, there's been tensions in the past and things like that. But things seem a lot mellower now. I spoke to George not too long ago, and he says, obviously, Dokken and Lynch Mob, they do gigs together and things like that. So yeah. Things are a lot nicer on that front between everybody nowadays then, yeah?
Oh yeah, you know, we've done like 30 or something shows with George. It's been great. Everyone gets along and we have a good time, and it's been really great. And I think it's been great for the fans.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Because I think that it's been something special for him coming up.
Absolutely. And just one last question. I've got one here from Connor Butler. He says, I'm a big fan of yours. I want to know, will you be getting a signature guitar model?
Thank you, Connor. I had one through Fender, through Charvel years ago. They didn't do that many, but it was, they sold them all out. You know, it's funny you mention it, because just last night I spoke to Mike McGregor, who was my A&R guy when I was at Fender. And he was the guy that did that signature guitar model for me. But, you know, I haven't really thought about it. I would do it if I was approached to do it. Yeah, you know, but yeah. I would do it if someone approached me to do it and wanted to do it the right way, not a cheapy way. So, yeah.
Fantastic stuff. Well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you so much for joining us here on VRP Rocks, and best of luck with the new album as well. And is there going to be a tour? Are you coming to Europe, the UK?
Yeah, we're planning. Excuse me. We're going to be coming there, I think, in August. I don't know about the UK, but we're coming to Europe. The plan is in August, and I think we're going to do Japan. So. We're going to be touring a lot on this album starting 2024. And we have four more videos in the works too. We shot four more. So if we do the next four, that'll be seven videos total for a 10 song record, which is pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time, John. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Wonderful speaking with you.
There you go, the brilliant John Levin there. I hope you enjoyed that. Check out the band's new album, Heaven Comes Down. It's available to buy, stream and download from wherever you get your music from. Basically, support these bands while we still can. Anyway, that's it for me in this week's episode. Thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app so you get all the episodes. Loads more great guests and brilliant stories to come over the next few weeks. They come out every single Monday. Please leave VRP Rocks a 5-star review on the podcast app that you use. It makes a really big difference, really does. Check out the VRP Rocks YouTube channel as well, and give us a like, follow or subscribe on the social media channels too. Just search for VRP Rocks everywhere. So, until next week then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.